Tensions run high in Israel and the West Bank. Today, Monday, June 30th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hill, sitting in for Marco Werman. Three missing Israeli teenagers are now confirmed dead. The hunt is on for their killers.
They're saying that hundreds of Israeli soldiers have actually flooded that area and closed off all of the main roads.
Also today, North Korea says it will put two American tourists on trial. And later, Washington's multinational cab drivers are banding together for protection.
Sometimes we might have up and down. We come from different background and different culture. But at least in our pain, we are the same.
And reaction to Izzy the Ocelot's prediction for tomorrow's U.S. game at the World Cup.
What can I say? I'm so happy that a small-brained feline has decided that Belgium's going to win the match tomorrow.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. There's word now on the fate of three Israeli teenagers whose disappearance has become a national obsession. The Israeli military says that the bodies of the three have been found in the West Bank. We turn now to Shira Frankel. She's Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed, and she is in Jerusalem. Shira, bring us up to date on what we know about this case so far.
So a few hours ago, Israeli officials confirmed that the bodies of the three teenagers had been found. Those bodies had been buried in a field that were just a couple miles away from where they were kidnapped. The IDF search for them had included the entire West Bank. There was even talk of them looking further afield. And the fact that they were found so close to where they were kidnapped, taken into a car just after 10:30 at night earlier this month, has led investigators to believe that it was, in fact, two wanted Palestinian men from the Hebron area who took them.
Where they were found is just outside the West Bank city of Hebron.
It is. They were in an area called Gush Etzion, which is an Israeli settlement block, and they were leaving, heading back to their parents from a yeshiva where they had been studying that evening when they were kidnapped.
They were hitchhiking, as I understand it.
They were. Hitchhiking is actually incredibly common in the West Bank. It's part of what a lot of the settlers consider their culture there. They feel that they can come and go on the roads between the various settlements and that they should be able to be safe doing so.
Now, these three teenagers, Gilad Sha'ar, Naftali Frankel, and Ayel Yifrak, they were hitchhiking home, as you said. Tell us about this area where they were found near Hebron. What's that area like?
So I was actually there just earlier this week. It's a huge open field, which I think at one point was cultivated for agriculture. At this point is lying fallow. It's just north of Hebron, and it's in an area where there's actually quite a few caves, which, according to one of the Israeli officials I spoke to earlier tonight, was one of the reasons that they were quite difficult to find. There's been mixed reports, but the running assumption now is that the people who did kidnap them probably shot them very close to the time of the kidnapping, buried their bodies, and then fled to one of the nearby caves. There's an untold number there. It's incredibly difficult terrain, very, very easy to hide in. And so Israeli officials are continuing their search, but there's a lot of questions going around over whether they'll actually be able to find the men who are behind this.
Now, there are details coming out about this case and how it was investigated and what might have actually happened at the time these teenagers were abducted. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of accusations that this case was mishandled from the very beginning. Israeli police received a phone call from one of the teenagers saying, "I'm being taken," and ignored it for quite some time. The police officer who happened to take the call was quite young, inexperienced, but a lot of blame is being thrown their way. There's also reports that Israeli officials kept a lot under gag order and that they had intelligence as long ago as a week ago to say that these three teenagers were probably no longer alive. According to one of the Israeli officials involved in the investigation, who spoke to me earlier today, they did find blood and other remains in a burnt-out car nearby the site where they were kidnapped. And in the phone call that the teenager made to police, there's a gunshot that can be heard at one point.
Now, there was a huge search that went on for these three teenagers. You've reported that more than 240 Palestinians were arrested since the search began a few weeks ago. I know you've reached some Palestinians in Hebron. What's their reaction to this?
They're saying that hundreds of Israeli soldiers have actually flooded that area and closed off all of the main roads. We're also hearing that IDF soldiers are going house to house in the area around where two of the suspected men lived, and that at least two homes in the area have been demolished. One of the Palestinians I spoke to also said that a lot of youths have gathered in the area, that they had rocks, and that there's a lot of fear that there's going to be clashes tonight between local Palestinians in Hebron and the IDF there.
We've been speaking to Shira Frankel. She's Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. She's in Jerusalem. Thank you so much, Shira.
Thanks.
Tonight's developments are only going to heighten tensions between Israelis and Palestinians, and that could make life more difficult for Israeli Christians, who often find themselves torn between whether to ally themselves with Israel or with other Israeli Arabs. That dilemma was highlighted recently during the visit of Cardinal Bishara Rai, the Patriarch of Maronite Christians. Rai was the first Lebanese cardinal to visit Israel. His goal was to urge Christians to stick together as members of a tiny minority. As Daniela Chesla reports, the cardinal may have been surprised by how much Christians in Israel are still struggling with their own identity.
Cardinal Rai was introduced by a member of the local Maronite community, but really, he needed no introduction. He is, after all, the religious equivalent of a rock star. The cardinal's visit feels like a big party. It's a rare and stunning thing to see a Lebanese priest in an Israeli village. The two countries are officially at war, though priests have a special dispensation to travel back and forth. Few ever do. The cardinal spoke at the entrance of an old stone church, one of the only remaining buildings from the Maronite village of Kfar Biram. During its 1948 war for independence, Israel asked residents to leave for 2 weeks and never let them come back. Former residents and their descendants have been trying to return ever since. In recent months, a few hundred activists have pitched tents on the site, raising chickens to show they could revive the village. Cardinal Rai said he'll ask the Vatican to get involved. But the cardinal's festive visit masks a tough question. Where do Maronite Christians fit in today's Israel? Shadi Khalul helped coordinate the event.
We see in Syria, in Iraq, in Egypt, we see that there is no future for Christians in these Arab Islamic countries. So I prefer to live with my Jewish brother and defend this country.
Khalul served in an elite unit of the Israeli army. He's now part of a group encouraging Christian Israelis to enlist. He says Maronites can serve because they're not Arab or Palestinians. They're descendants of Aramaeans, a group that originated in modern-day Syria a few thousand years before Christ. Khalul is also trying to revive the Aramaean language, Aramaic, which was spoken by Jesus but has been nearly forgotten in the past few centuries.
The Maronites has identity, and we would love to keep it and preserve it and not to get involved with Arab-Israeli conflict.
But the wider Maronite community, which generally identifies as Israeli Arab, isn't so sure. Attorney Michelle Aoun, whose parents fled the village of Biram, says Khalul is buried in the past.
This is ridiculous. You are what you are today. You are what your father was maybe 50 years ago. But you can't be something that your ancestors 3,000-4,000 years ago became, okay?
10th grader Asil Luka certainly doesn't care much for history or her supposed Aramaean roots. I ask if she speaks Aramaic, and she chuckles. Her answer catches the ear of a man standing nearby.
It's a dead language. I don't care about it anymore.
It's not dead language. We are still praying also in Aramaic in our Maronite church. We're speaking Aramaic.
Okay,
school, there's also few kids are learning Aramaic.
This division over the responsibility of Maronites to remember their past and their loyalty to Israel is at an all-time high right now. Amal Jamal is a political science professor at Tel Aviv University. He says the rise of Islamic fundamentalist groups, like ISIS, is forcing Maronites to make a choice. Do they stay with their fellow Arabic-speaking Palestinians, or do they join with a stable country like Israel?
You have those who still want to keep and maintain their Arab identity and their affiliation with the Palestinian people. And you have those who prefer to view the future as part of Israeli society, hoping that Israel can provide them with more safety and stability for the future.
The stakes are high. Maronites supported the regime of Bashar Assad in Syria, but have since suffered attacks by both the government and by Islamist rebels. Most of Iraq's Christians, including a sizable Maronite community, left over the last decade, and thousands are fleeing in the current turmoil. After Cardinal Rai finished talking, Maronite believers lined up outside the church and filed in to shake his hand. Rai looked parishioners in the eyes, shook their hands, and touched their faces. He came to help the community stay connected, but that sense of togetherness is getting harder to maintain. For The World, I'm Daniela Cheslow, Kfar Biram, Israel.
Two American tourists are going on trial in North Korea. North Korea's official news agency made the announcement today. The men are being investigated for committing, quote, hostile acts against North Korea after entering the country. And we're talking about one of the most reclusive and unpredictable governments on Earth. Adam Cathcart follows North Korea closely. He's a lecturer at Leeds University in Britain. Adam, what do we know about these two guys?
Well, we know that one gentleman has a kind of a track record of being interested in Christianity and maybe disposed to kind of missionary activities, Jeffrey Fowle, who's 56 years old. And then a younger man, Matthew Miller, all that we know really about him is that he has he tore up his visa when he got to the country and asked for asylum. So you're talking about two very different ends of the spectrum of kind of North Korea opinion. People, one person going ostensibly to change the country, to try to encourage kind of a revival of Christianity there, which the state is really opposed to. And then another one who kind of says, here I am, you know, take me in. And the state responds very poorly to both of those trends.
I'm curious in the second case why they respond poorly. Wouldn't it be just as much of a PR coup for North Korea to welcome the guy who wants asylum?
Well, I think that they don't necessarily trust people originally. You know, sort of statements of intent don't mean so much. And I think that you know, while it could be a propaganda coup, I think that the kind of the negatives or the downsides outweighed the positives clearly for the DPRK.
Now, Adam, you refer to the North Korea as the DPRK. Remind us what those initials stand for.
Sure. It's the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, as opposed to the Republic of Korea, which is South Korea. And so the title is kind of one of these wonderful legacies of the socialist internationalism in the late 1940s and kind of this optimistic social system that was put in place that the North Koreans themselves are still rather proud of, you know, kind of gender equality, land reform, you know, no tuition being paid for university, things like that. They got through a massive war. The system continued to kind of muddle along through the 70s and 80s, but it's really, really broken down in the last 20 years.
And of course, the chutzpah at using the adjective democratic in the technical legal name of the country.
Sure, sure, absolutely. The system is very much one party, you know, sort of Stalinist model, throw in a bit of sprinkle of Korean Confucianism and authoritarianism that's very sort of Chinese in a way, connected to the legalist system. And so there, yeah, it's an amalgam.
Now, when are these trials supposed to take place? They're not happening immediately, as I understand it.
No, and that's the thing about the North Koreans controlling the tempo, as would be expected. The fact of the matter is it's not that they're gathering evidence or taking more time to do the investigations. It's just basically these trials are being done when it's politically expedient for the country and when there's more sort of they want more foreign eyeballs on North Korea.
Why is North Korea so allergic to any kind of religious activity?
Great question. I think it goes back to the origins of the state and the division with the South. There used to be a large number of Christians in the North, and Pyongyang, in fact, was kind of a hub for Presbyterian activity. They used to call it the Jerusalem of Northeast Asia. But with the Korean War, many Christians went to the South, and prior to the Korean War, there were really kind of strong attacks and pressure put on Christians to leave the country. And so since then, people like Billy Graham will occasionally go to North Korea. There is a church. There's a Russian Orthodox church. They say religion is a part of our constitution. You have the right to practice what you like. But in fact, the state religion is more or less Kimism, or the worship and deification of the leader. All three generations of Kim leaders now, which is one of the most interesting and sort of disturbing aspects of where the new North Korea is going. It's just in the same direction as the old North Korea, more or less worshiping a 30-year-old dictator.
Adam Cathcart is an expert on Northeast Asia at Leeds University. Thank you, Adam.
Absolutely. Glad to speak with you.
Coming up on The World, the impact of the Ebola virus on chimps and gorillas. That's on PRI Public Radio International. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. 400 and counting. That's the number of deaths from the latest outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus in West Africa. The outbreak is in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and they're grappling with one of the most lethal and contagious diseases on the planet. And the virus doesn't just affect humans. It also kills apes, including chimps and gorillas. And here's a terrible irony. Laws to protect animals around the world may be actually hindering the development of an Ebola vaccine that could help them. The BBC's Victoria Gill has been looking into this story. And Victoria, talk about the law of unintended consequences. What's going on here?
Yes, quite. Well, this is because the US is actually the last developed country where testing on chimpanzees, biomedical testing, is allowed. And because of some great work that's been done by animal welfare campaigners and specialists and primate researchers, the National Institutes of Health in the US are planning to retire all of their biomedical testing chimps. Now, the problem with that is that when we're looking at something like the Ebola virus and actually lots of other diseases that are threatening very endangered primates, we might be able to develop drugs and vaccines that could potentially help save some of these endangered primates from extinction. But they would need to be tested on apes before they could be used in the wild. So what researchers, particularly Dr. Peter Walsh at the University of Cambridge, who has been testing an experimental Ebola vaccine, what he's saying is that we need these primate centres, ironically, in order to be able to save some of these wild apes.
So it's sort of interesting here, the US was sort of behind the trend of halting invasive testing on chimps. And now it sort of has this opportunity if it would just kind of ease up.
Well, sort of thereby hangs the quandary, really, because the primate centres are actually sort of overstocked at the moment with some of these apes. And that's because there were a lot of apes bred up, chimpanzees specifically, bred up for HIV testing. So the NIH has now got specialists onto a panel to advise them what they should do with their chimps, and the expert advice is retire these animals. Now, the NIH is involved only in human biomedical health research. So it's not really their goal to test vaccines for the benefit of apes. So what this has done is really open up a discussion about whether that research could be carried out either in these primate centres still, whether there could be a special primate centre for conservation research, or whether actually this research could be carried out in sanctuaries that are there for the benefit of these apes. So it sort of started a new discussion in amongst primate specialists and conservationists as to where and how this research could be carried out.
Just for the sake of argument, if everything went according to plan, how would they actually get the vaccine into the animals in the wild?
That's a key question, because with some of these parks, the animals are specifically habituated. They're part of conservation tourism programs, and they're very habituated. They're used to people being around them. So what Dr. Walsh in Cambridge is saying is that those animals would be easy to reach. Other researchers that I've spoken to who work out in Congo and other places in Central Africa, incredibly remote regions, and work with animals that do a lot more exploring of the forest, say that that would be incredibly difficult. So you have another problem there of the development of a vaccine that might not be able to reach wild animals. But what some researchers are saying is that we're so far progressed in terms of some of the vaccines that we could develop. They're so far along that clinical development path that it wouldn't cost very much money to complete that testing and at least get them into some of these habituated animals that are very easy to reach.
So a lot of issues to work out even if this vaccine is approved. The BBC's Victoria Gill, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Nothing says Scotland like kilts, bagpipes, and haggis. Though most people here in the U.S. don't know what's in it, they tend to shudder when they hear about it. And the U.S. government doesn't seem to want Americans to eat it either. It's blocked imports of haggis for more than 40 years. And now the British government is making a diplomatic push to change that. Hardeep Singh Kohli is a Scottish chef and broadcaster. Okay, Hardeep, what is haggis?
What is haggis? Can one sum up such an institution of food in mere words? Haggis is beauty. Haggis is poetry. Haggis is delicious. Haggis is the entrails of animals, basically, in a stomach that's boiled and cooked and is delicious.
Okay, specifically what animals? Let's get down and dirty.
Well, I can get down with you. As for dirty, it's all very clean. Everything's boiled. It's what we call the pluck of an animal. So it's the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, mixed with grains. And the thing about haggis that's quite surprising is its spiciness. It's very peppery, and it tends to take people by surprise in that regard. I'm actually talking to you from a place called Soho House, where every year I organise the annual Burn Supper, and we serve a beautiful plate of haggis, and it's always the greatest entertainment, which is saying something in a room full of whiskey-addled Scots. The greatest entertainment is to watch virgins to the haggis as their face changes with delight.
But tell me, what if you describe for our listeners, what does haggis taste like? What could you compare it to?
It's incomparable, is the truth. It has a beautiful texture in that everything's boiled and minced. So you have nuggets of flavour exploding across your tongue, mixed with oats. And it's the seasoning, really, that elevates it to another place. Very peppery. There's some exotic seasoning in there, too, in the more modern batches. No one really gives their secret away, but I suspect there may be cayenne pepper in some, a particular brand of celery salt in others. But
for those, it's also, of course, quintessentially Scottish, so people celebrate it in Scotland. But your name, Hardeep Singh Kohli, doesn't sound very Scottish. What's your own background?
Well, interestingly, I am the microcosm of haggis myself. My heritage is from the northwest of India, the Punjab, the land of spice, the land of strong flavours and great food. And I'm from Scotland, grew up in Glasgow. And in a way, that is what haggis is. It's very Scottish ingredients with this twist of spice and flavour. Again, it's very interesting. There's a very famous Scottish dish called Balmoral chicken, which is a chicken breast stuffed with haggis, wrapped in parma ham, poached in white wine with garlic and cream. And that is your entry-level experience of haggis. It's not completely on the plate. It's part of another thing. Haggis is a marvellous accompaniment.
So I know haggis is Scotland's national dish, but how popular is it really?
It is actually surprisingly popular. It's all our fish and chip shops in Scotland will serve haggis. But increasingly, chefs across the United Kingdom and increasingly across Europe are discovering haggis as an ingredient that gives that punch of flavour and gives that punch of texture and can really, you know, I'm working on a recipe just now for haggis and hake. I think those go quite well together. I'm just perfecting that in the next few weeks. So it's eaten more regularly than people know, and it's eaten more at home now than ever before.
Hardeep Singh Kohli is a Scottish chef and broadcaster. We've been speaking to him from London. Hardeep, thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure, and happy 4th of July when it comes.
Thank you. So would you eat haggis? Have you eaten haggis? You can vote in our poll at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up on The World, comic book author Gene Luen Yang gives us a new reading on Superman.
He is pretty much an immigrant. His parents sent him to America to have a better life, and he has these two different cultures that he has to negotiate. He's like not only the prototypical superhero, he's also the prototypical immigrant.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The weather is hot and sunny, but how many of you were indoors this weekend watching World Cup soccer? There were some great games, including that penalty shootout between Chile and Brazil. Well, the world soccer guy William Troop is in Brazil to see some World Cup matches. And William, you've been in Brazil since Friday. What's it been like?
It's been an absolute blast, I have to say. I mean, things here on the ground, from the airports to public transportation to the stadiums that I've seen, are working beautifully. It's well organized, no trouble at all. So it's been really exciting, and there's so many soccer fans everywhere. The planes are full of soccer fans going to and from games. It's just been a lot of excitement all around.
And you were at yesterday's nail-biter of a game between Costa Rica and Greece, and we in the office remember before you left that you were kind of ho-hum about this.
You know, yes, you're right. On paper, I wasn't really expecting it to be an exciting game, but, you know, as they say, games are not played on paper. They're played on the ground, on the pitch, and once the two teams were on the field, it was just really exciting, starting with the fact that the stadium was, you know, I don't know, about half Costa Rican. I've never seen so many Costa Ricans in one place. The Costa Ricans were winning until the very end of the regular time in the game. The Greeks tied it, you know, at the last minute. Real drama there. And then they go into extra time. The players were exhausted. I can tell you from my own drenched shirt that it was humidity over 90%, I think. I mean, it was exhausting to be out there as a spectator. I can't imagine, you know, playing. And these guys were giving it their all on the field. And then came the penalty shootout. I mean, I couldn't ask for more drama and more excitement. It was great.
And now you're about to head to Salvador and Bahia for the big game tomorrow, USA versus Belgium. Have you got your red, white, and blue face paint ready?
I have an American flag, and I have my my U.S. jersey ready to go. So I think I'm as ready as I'm going to be. I've seen a lot of Americans on the planes and walking around in the cities where we've been. They seem just as pumped as I am to watch that game. It should be really exciting.
And you've talked about all the highlights, but what's the most surprising thing you found in this trip to Brazil?
One of the things that I've noticed that I didn't expect is just how many fans from other countries in Latin America are here. I haven't been in cities, for example, where Colombia is playing, but I see Colombians everywhere. There are people in their yellow Colombia shirts everywhere, on the planes, in the airports, and walking around. It's equal numbers for people from, like, Costa Rica, as I said. I mean, at the game last night that you see, there were a lot of Mexicans in the stands last night, a lot of Chileans.
And that heartbreaking game, of course, between Mexico and the Netherlands.
Yes, that was a real bummer if you were rooting for Mexico. I watched that game at a bus station.
Which, of course, you were.
I was, of course. I was born in Mexico, so I root for Mexico whenever they're on the field. And I was watching that game at a bus station in Recife, and it was just a heartbreaker to see it end the way it did at the last minute with a penalty, which I have to say, a lot of Mexican fans and myself aren't quite sure it was a penalty.
So who do you think is going to go all the way?
It's going to be really hard to beat Brazil at its game at home. I think my money would still go on Brazil at this point. But I think, you know, there are some teams that, including Belgium, which the U.S. is playing tomorrow, that it doesn't seem to me have quite started playing yet. And if a team like Belgium starts playing, and it's going to be really hard for the U.S. tomorrow. You know, there are several teams that have a good chance. The Brazilians don't look completely invincible to me.
The world's William Troop, possibly the world's biggest soccer fan, in Brazil for the World Cup. Thanks so much, William.
Thank you, Carol, and go USA!
The world's Clark Boyd is in Belgium, and we're going to find out how Belgians are preparing for the big USA matchup. But first, we're going to check in with the world's Nina Porzucchi at the Tropical Rainforest at the Franklin Park Zoo here in Boston, where Izzy, our World Cup predicting ocelot, has made his next prediction for tomorrow's U.S. match against Belgium.
4-1 to 4-5. You can let Izzy out now.
10-4.
Okay. Let's see what he does. Oh, he's out. He's active. He's going straight to Belgium. And it's Belgium for the win.
Clark Boyd, you are in Belgium. Reaction to the news from Izzy.
Well, what can I say? I'm so happy that a small-brained feline has decided that Belgium's going to win the match tomorrow. No, but seriously, it's actually very, very exciting to be here. The entire city and indeed the entire country is very much geared up for tomorrow's match. Everywhere you look, there are Belgian flags out, much more than I've ever seen before back when I lived here. It's amazing just the spirit here. Lots of little kids running around with soccer jerseys on. And of course, even Belgian landmarks like the little statue mannequin piece of the little boy relieving himself has been dressed up on and off with a Red Devils soccer uniform. So there you go.
So Clark, as you mentioned, you lived in Belgium for a while, but you're American. I'm assuming some divided loyalties. Who are you going to root for?
Well, I have to tell you, Carol, I never in a million years when I booked our family vacation 6 months ago would have thought that we'd come down to a World Cup that would see a matchup between Belgium and the United States. And I will have to say that my loyalties are torn. On the one hand, it's been fantastic to watch the United States, get through the group round it is a world sport, and it's great to see the United States competing at such a high level. On the other hand, I have to say my heartstrings, you know, are torn, and I come back to Belgium time and time again, this plucky little country that has some incredibly good soccer players right now. It's also been fantastic to see their run. And I think me and along with a lot of Belgians here look at the Belgian team on paper and say they should actually be playing a lot better than they are. So I have to say that, you know, since I'm here in Belgium, I'm probably going to go with the Red Devils tomorrow night.
So do the Belgians seem as surprised to be up against the U.S. and have advanced as far as they have as the Americans are? A surprise that they are where they are?
Well, Carol, you have to remember the Belgians haven't actually had a team make it to the World Cup since 1986. So just getting a team into the group stages felt like a big deal for them. The players on this Belgian team, they play in some of the finest club teams across Europe. And so when you put these players on the same team together, you know, the Belgian national team, you look at it on paper and you think this team should be incredibly exciting to watch, should score a lot of goals, should be a great, great squad. And I think a lot of people feel like they haven't quite lived up to that yet. But now that we're into the knockout rounds, the general feeling is that they're going to be playing a lot better and that they will be able to move forward. One of the interesting things looking at the reaction in the newspaper has been a lot of newsprint and a lot of space online has been devoted to, you know, the Belgian media trying to figure out how is it all of a sudden that America has such a great team. So I think that they see the United States as, they're not taking the United States lightly. They see the United States as a formidable opponent. But I would say that they have every confidence that they will move forward.
Clark Boyd, thank you so much. It's very exciting speaking to you from Belgium. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Carol, and go Red Devils.
You can check out the latest Izzy Picks video at PRI.org. And while you're there, we've got other World Cup goodies for you. Like, did you know that France has more of its homegrown players competing for other nations than any other country? What? We've got a graphic explaining just how that works at PRI.org. And one more World Cup note. We've been asking you to share your favorite soccer-related songs, past or present. Many of you have weighed in, and we want to play one of your suggestions now. Ryan E. Poppy wrote on our Facebook page that he loves the 2010 World Cup song Waving Flag by rapper Kanon. Keep posting your favorite soccer tunes at our Facebook page, facebook.com/PRI the world. Celebration, it surrounds us, every nation. Taxicab drivers around the world are up in arms about Uber. They say the mobile app that connects drivers and riders is taking away their business because it doesn't have to follow the same rules. But in Washington, D.C., taxi drivers are upset about more than just that app. Reporter Naomi Gingold explains.
Adis Gabriselassie is a taxicab driver in Washington, D.C. Like a lot of other immigrant drivers, he's pretty highly educated, formerly an accountant. But he's been driving a cab in the district for about 14 years. And he likes the independence.
Even though not that much respected job, I don't know the reason why, but you do have your own flexible time. You can work when you like it, when you want it, not working when you don't want it.
You can take care of the kids, take classes.
If I'm traveling back home, that job is still waiting for me. You know, I own this own, so.
And go home to Ethiopia without losing your job. In many ways, D.C. is actually a really good place to set up shop as a cab driver. It's the only major metro area in the U.S. where most drivers are independent owners and no company dominates. There are more than 100 cab companies in D.C., and unlike New York or Boston, licenses are pretty cheap. But then there's the D.C. Taxicab Commission, which pretty much controls everything drivers do.
Driving a cab is not the easy job. Some of the drivers get abused. they know on their hearts there is no fairness in this city.
In addition to giving out licenses, the commission also acts as a kind of quasi-police force for taxis. Inspectors can ticket drivers for a host of things, from minor traffic infractions to defects in their cars to bad paperwork. The commission says it's just trying to make sure that passengers get safe, comfortable rides. But drivers complain bitterly that inspectors ticket unfairly and arbitrarily, and that just one ticket can equal a week's income. Many drivers believe they're treated poorly in part because they're immigrants. At a hearing last year, the taxi commission refused to let a driver originally from Ethiopia speak because he didn't provide them with a written statement. Even though his English was fine, they said rules were rules.
And I want to make a comment to the to you, madam. The reason we're asking for written testimony is because a lot of our cab drivers have difficulty with our language.
Later on, an African-American driver was allowed to speak, though he also didn't have anything on paper to hand out. Some drivers had talked about unionizing, but previous attempts fell apart when drivers organized along ethnic lines. And then...
One night at Union Station.
One night, last August, at DC's Union Station, driver Jesse Black was sitting in the taxi line.
I was sitting there reading the Washington Post. And the guys were having this discussion, and they were interrupting me reading my paper. And just about that time, Mo pulls up.
That's my nickname. They cannot say Muhammad. They have to say Mo.
So we started talking, and we said, well, the only way we're going to defeat this negativity toward us is that we form an association or something.
So he called me always the Mo. He's the man here.
Mohamed Samantir, or Mo, is an immigrant from Somalia. Jesse Black, born and raised in the U.S. The other guys that night were Gabri Selassie from Ethiopia and another driver from Nigeria. So last September, the men booked a room for 200 people to talk about a possible union. 400 showed up. The next meeting, more than 1,000 drivers came. They voted to start an association and work with the Teamsters. Gabri Selassie, Mo Samantir, Jesse Black, they all knew one thing.
We need to have a trust between us. Everybody does have the same problem.
The cab driver is a cab driver. That's no matter where you come from.
We're all from different ethnic groups, absolutely. I think in the past has played some part in us not getting together, but we overcame that by saying that we're all taxi cab operators.
Today, the Leadership Council is a mix of ethnicities, religions, and even genders. Mo Samantir and Adis Gabri Selassie are on the council. Gabri Selassie is the first to admit that they don't always agree on everything.
Sometimes we might have up and down. Don't forget that. We come from different background and different culture. But at least in our pain, we are the same. At least we agree with something.
Jesse Black handles drivers' complaints and often goes to court with drivers. And they're already making a difference.
What's going on, man?
I have a complaint.
Yes, okay, come on.
They've had tickets thrown out, they've got legislation in the works, and for the first time, they feel like the Taxi Cab Commission hears them and is taking them seriously. They now spend their days going to hearings, studying city laws, organizing,
Hello.
And, of course,
Hi.
Driving the streets of D.C.
1914 Connecticut, please.
Okay.
For the world, I'm Naomi Gingold in Washington, D.C.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Wonderful.
And you're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. If you think about it, a superhero story is kind of an immigrant story. It's the story of someone who's struggling to fit in. Gene Luen Yang set out to explore that theme in his new book, The Shadow Hero. His graphic novel resurrects a Golden Age comic book hero known as the Green Turtle. That masked man is thought to be the very first Asian American superhero, created by the late cartoonist Chu Hing. But the Green Turtle lacked one important thing that all superheroes need, an origin story. And Yang was just the right guy to create one.
I'm a lifelong superhero fan. I grew up reading superhero comics. And I really believe that superheroes are quintessentially American. You know, they were created in America. They were invented in America. They're most popular in America. And in a lot of ways, they embody American ideals. And if you look carefully at the narrative conventions within this genre, it's really deeply embedded with the immigrant experience. You know, the creators
stranger,
of Batman,
somebody,
Superman.
Yeah, stranger coming somewhere and trying to adapt and kind of figure out his or her place there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The creators of all the major superheroes, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, the Hulk, they were all the children of immigrants. And if you look at Superman, who's the prototypical superhero, he is pretty much an immigrant. His parents sent him to America to have a better life, and he has these two different cultures that he has to negotiate. He has Kryptonian culture and American culture. He has two different names. He has an alien name with a hyphen in it, and he has this American name, Clark Kent. So, you know, just within his origin, within who he is, he's like not only the prototypical superhero, he's also the prototypical immigrant.
So how did you make the Green Turtles story special and unique to Asian Americans?
You know, I think if you look at Superman and Batman and Spider-Man, the immigrant's experience is embedded within there, but it's subtext. You know, it's not explicit. And I wanted to bring that out. I wanted to make that explicit. So the Green Turtle gave me an opportunity to do this because Chu Hing never got around to telling that origin story. So I just thought there was a lot to play with there. I wanted to establish this hero as the first Asian American hero.
And you sort of place his story in a Chinatown, and you also give him a kind of tiger mom mother. Was that intentional?
Yes. Yeah, you know, I worked with a friend of mine named Sunny Liu on it, so I only did the story. Sunny is an amazing cartoonist, and he did all of the art. But Sunny and I, we actually started on this project before the infamous Tiger Mom article came out in the Wall Street Journal. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh my gosh, we need to get this done because we're missing out on this cultural moment, right? We're missing out on throwing our voices into this conversation. But like with a lot of my work, what I'm interested in is taking stereotypes and undermining them by fleshing them out. So I wanted Hank's mother, the main character's mother, to start off like the stereotypical Tiger's mom. And then I hope by the end of the story that we move her beyond that.
Give our listeners a thumbnail sketch of your story, of the Green Turtle story that you've written.
The main character's name is Hank Chu. He's a Chinese-American teenager growing up in 1930s Chinatown. And all he really wants is to take over his family's business. His father runs a grocery store right in the middle of Chinatown, and he feels very safe and very secure there. But then one day his mom meets a character called the Anchor of Justice, who's basically our Superman stand-in. And she's so fascinated by this idea of superheroes that she wants her son to become a superhero. So she begins plotting to make her son into a superhero. And eventually, Hank embraces that role for himself. So we really wanted, Sunny and I really wanted to use superheroes as a way of talking about how people become immigrants. I think, you know, I'm the child of immigrants, and I think in a lot of ways, you know, my parents chose for me to become an American. Those were choices that were made before I was even born. And at some point, that ideal became my own. At some point, I wanted to be a part of America as well. So I wanted Hank to go through that in the same way, only with superheroes instead of being an American.
Gene, at what age did you get into superheroes and comic books?
I bought my first comic in the fifth grade. My mom took me to our local bookstore. The comic that I wanted to buy was a Marvel team-up starring The Thing, who's this big rock monster, and Rom the Space Knight, who's a superhero that looks like a robot. But my mom thought those two characters looked too scary, so she bought me a Superman comic instead. And that Superman comic blew my mind. I've been obsessed with comics ever since.
So you have resurrected what may be the first Asian American superhero, the Green Turtle. How many Asian American superheroes are out there today?
There are more and more now. I grew up in the 80s, and back then there were maybe just a handful. You know, the X-Men tend to be fairly diverse, and there was Jubilee, who was a Chinese-American girl who grew up in Southern California, and she really seemed like somebody I would have hung out with in high school, so I always loved her character. And then there was also Psylocke, who started off British, but she was kidnapped by these ninjas and given an Asian body. So I kind of count her as well. So there were just a handful when I was growing up. But nowadays, they're a decent number. I think both Marvel and DC, the two major superhero comics publishing companies, have made a lot of strides towards diversity. But, you know, I don't think American comics yet reflect the diversity of our world, but they're getting there.
Now, I have to ask, you yourself wanted to go into a field that wasn't terribly traditional for Asian Americans. Did you meet resistance from your own parents?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially my dad. I think my mom has artistic inclinations. She was more understanding. My dad is very practical. You know, he has a very practical sensibility. He has a very practical approach to life. And he really basically wanted me to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. And now that I'm an adult, now that I have kids of my own, I can see where he's coming from. You know, making money from art is a very difficult thing. And I think my dad just really wanted me to stay away from heartache, you know, and pain. But at the same time, we've come to an agreement on that issue, my dad and I. So it's nice now. He's really supportive of what I do now.
So you've done this book, The Shadow Hero, Reviving the Green Turtle. Will you do more episodes of The Green Turtle and produce more stories and adventures for him?
I would love to. I would love to. I think he's a very rich character, but a lot of that depends on Sonny. If Sonny's willing to continue to work with me, a lot of that depends on our publisher, and a lot of that depends on how this first book does.
Gene Luen Yang is the author of a number of graphic novels. His latest is The Shadow Hero, which resurrects the story of the earliest known Asian American superhero, the Green Turtle. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you.
And to see photos of the Green Turtle in action, head to our website, PRI.org. And that's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Ann Cerisi. By the Ford Foundation. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.